Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Osprey might just be the unofficial bird of the Cape and Islands. This large migratory bird of prey calls our region home from mid-March through October. Also known as fish hawks, the dark brown and white birds can be seen soaring overhead, diving for fish, or incubating eggs on their enormous nests. The use of the pesticide DDT in the 1950s and 60s caused the population of osprey and other birds of prey to plummet. In the decades following banning of DDT, osprey numbers have rebounded. Today, we talk osprey, both the amazing success story of these birds and what might threaten their numbers in the future. We start the hour with David Gessner. He's the Keenan Distinguished Professor in Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He's also the author of 14 books, including The Return of the Osprey, published 25 years ago. Welcome back.
It makes me feel pretty old, Mindy.
I was just thinking the same thing.
I spoke about it on this show.
It was like 25 years ago, and I remember us talking about that when it first came out. So Return of the Osprey follows a season of osprey on the Cape. Do you remember when you first became aware of osprey on the Cape?
I do, because I did a drawing of one in my very first book. But I, you know, more poignantly, I'm aware of not being aware of them my whole childhood here. And then I came back in my 20s to live for a little bit. And it just was kind of startling to see at the end of the jetty, this, you know, big hawk that I, you know, a bird I had never really seen before on the Cape. Because they, you know, Alan Poole is going to be with us later on. But there were zero on the Cape at one point,
yeah. You
know, and now obviously there are hundreds and hundreds.
So talk about what prompted you to write about them and how much did you know about the osprey before you started?
Well, I might repeat myself from 25 years ago, but I'll assume
we don't remember.
the short version is that I had moved back to my real hometown of Worcester and found out I had testicular cancer when I was 30. And I was saved from Worcester by moving to Boulder, Colorado to go to school. And I wrote a book about how much I loved Cape Cod when I was in Colorado. And then my wife and I moved back to promote the book, thinking we'd be here for a couple of months, and it ended up being 7 years. Of course, I turned right around and wrote a book about love in Colorado once I got to the Cape. But the whole book was about kind of finding home, and we at one point really thought we were going to stay on the Cape forever. So I had meanwhile become this thing called a nature writer. And it kind of irked me. I always thought of myself as a, you know, an essayist, a novelist, other things. But each book came out and they'd say, he's a fine nature writer. And I was like, so I wrote an essay called Sick of Nature, which was kind of my declaration of independence from the genre. And an editor for Algonquin Books read it. But in the essay, Sick of Nature, I go off on a tangent and describe how beautiful birds are. And she called me up and said, I'd really like to do a book with you about birds. And I was like, damn, I can't escape this. If I do this book, I'm forevermore a nature writer. And of course, I really admired people like Robert Finch and John Hay, and I was part nature writer. So I said yes, and then she did something miraculous. She offered me an advance. So I could quit my job at the Orleans bookstore and go out on the marsh. But before that, I should back up a second and say, she didn't specify bird. And I started to think, oh, I don't want to do a book about a semi-palmated plover, titmouse, or little fancy birds. And then I remembered that upon my return, you know, ospreys had returned to the neighborhood too. Mm-hmm. So I said, ospreys? She said, sure. I quit my job. I bought a telescope. And you just mentioned mid-March. My birthday is March 15th, the Ides of March. And I went out early March and watched as the birds came back in mid-March and really didn't know a lot about ospreys, but learned during that year that when you become obsessed with something, you can learn a lot awfully fast.
Yeah. So it's not a field guide or even natural history. How do you describe the book?
Well, I really like what Helen MacDonald said in the new introduction, and she stresses that it refuses to be one thing, and you know that it's part memoir. It's about my relationship with my brother, which I see kind of metaphorically in the bird's relation. It's about an astute member of an audience when I spoke a few years ago said, I think this is a book about writing. Because obsessed as the birds are with fish, you know, osprey, that's what they focus on, and that bold, exciting commitment when they dive for fish. I felt like this was a moment in my life when I got obsessed and focused, not just on ospreys, but on making a book, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's about writing, it's about family, it's about trying to find place, and hopefully it's a natural history as well. Mm-hmm. It's a beginner's natural history where you kind of follow me as I learn more. So it's a messy book. And I think that's fitting because, you know, one of the things I loved about ospreys right away, one thing I loved was their athleticism. The other was their slovenliness, their sloppiness. And the nest I watched, the main nest, had strands of Easter tinsel and boat strings and had a naked Barbie doll jammed into the middle of it because they're pack rats and they're not neat birds.
Yeah.
And my dad used to call me Dirty Dave, so I had empathy.
To identify, yeah. So osprey have received a big following because of the nest webcams. You wrote this book 25 years ago. Talk about how you observe the birds, especially when in the nest.
Well, you know, they're really great to observe. The reason we know so much about them is they're gregarious, they're not shy. So I did not use a nest cam, but by setting up, you know, a little far back with the telescope, I couldn't see, you know, interior of the nest. Though when those first black reptilian heads of the young popped up, it was a real, you know, incredible thrill. But I could see a lot because they do things out in the open. That's one of their, you know, that's one of the reasons we love them so much is they're not reclusive. They're out there. And for me, I had gone up to visit with Alan Poole, who's going to be your guest a little later. And he'd literally written the book on ospreys. It still is the book on ospreys. And he had been kind of my Obi-Wan Kenobi as I started to delve into osprey world. And one of the things he said to me is, you've got to learn to live on osprey time. And so I got out to the nest and I sat there and I was bored to death, just sitting there as the birds kind of going out about their business early March. The male is gathering sticks and the female is building the nest and telling the male where to put them and rejecting some. But gradually I got better. And I got better, I was patient, because not because I'm some Zen master, but because I had to be patient to get what I wanted, which is exactly why a great blue heron or an osprey are patient. You know, in my food, what I was trying to get was learning and observing and writing everything down in my journal as I watched. Mm. So it was this great kind of process of accretion through the year where these details built up. And of course, at night, I was also fully in osprey mode. I was reading about their comeback from DDT. I was reading all the books on osprey, and gradually this was building up inside of me through the year.
Like all osprey all the time, right? So now the Huey osprey cam had to be turned off years ago because the public was upset by the bird's behavior toward the young, which you might call a bad mom, right? You also witnessed some disturbing behaviors in the nest. Talk about how that impacted you both in the moment and then in reflection.
Well, I witnessed a lot of beautiful moments, and one of my favorite was when the mother, the female, would rip into the fish that had been brought back and then delicately place it in the young's mouth. And that was, you know, beautiful. But I also, as you say, witnessed the opposite, a siblicide where a nest with, I believe, four young, really the smallest, the runt, was not getting any food and was being pecked savagely by the older siblings, and ultimately killed and chewed on a little bit too. So I mean, so to me, it was kind of here's the beauty and here's the harsh reality of it, and the two things married were interesting to me because I was trying to get through, you know, out of my own brain and into Osprey world. And that was part of Osprey world, that kind of the thing itself, the savagery of it. I mean, I got a little crazy by the end. There was a point where I wanted to feel what it was like to rip that fish apart. So I went up to the local market and got, a striper and got some pliers out. And I was on the back deck. I was wearing, I'm pretty sure, a bathing suit. The way my wife tells the story is I was wearing a loincloth, but I don't own a loincloth. So tearing it, you got the kind of feel of Osprey. And there was this kind of fanaticism that started to build up that I enjoyed. And I remember once walking out from watching one of the nests. I had four nests that I watched regularly. And as I walked out, somebody was coming in and his eyes were all lit up. And I wanted to say to him, have you found Osprey too? Because there was a religious fervor to the whole thing.
How did writing Return of the Osprey impact your career and also your writing?
Yeah, it very much did. The books I'd written before it were really essay collections. So I hadn't really, my wife's a novelist, and her first books, like a lot of novelists, were short stories. And it's a big jump from kind of episodic into something that's a whole book. And the way it did, I've been telling my grad students, like when I think I spoke to you about the Flacco book, that more and more I go on what I call vacations with a purpose. I went over to Finland to watch these eagle owls, but the whole time you're doing it, you're a dual creature because you're observing and you're trying to get really into it, but you're also, your writer brain is going and you're creating a narrative. And that was really the first summer or actually spring, summer and fall when I did that. And I had that journal and I wasn't consciously writing chapters yet, though I started to doodle, this fits here, this fits there. And I let it build in me because I felt I couldn't begin the book until they flew off in September. And when they did, it was like a starting gun going off. We were house sitting and, obviously the Cape, it doesn't empty out as much now, but it emptied out then. And all of a sudden, I really wrote most of the book in a month. Because, I'd been holding back, it was this restraint. And then boom. Now, of course, I edited it and went through many drafts. But and so that's something, so two things. One, I was writing a book, not a collection. And two, I got kind of a template from that year of getting really into something, letting it build, build, build. And then when it's time to go, the starting gun goes off and you go. So it was a writing lesson too, really. Yeah.
When you revisited the book, the 25th anniversary came near, what kinds of reflections did you have about the Osprey and yourself?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm speaking to you from University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And one of the ironic aspects of the book was, the next year my wife became pregnant and suddenly the idea of committing to the Cape and just being writers wasn't realistic. Health insurance and salary were pretty good. And some writers down here read the book and called me into interview. So the book basically ends saying, I will stay forever on Cape Cod, which is how I got my job down here. And 3 weeks after I got down here, well, first I learned that the mascot was the Seahawk down here. But there isn't a Seahawk, it's a fishhawk, but it's an Osprey basically. And 3 weeks after I got down here, some frat boys had sawed off the legs of the Osprey statue in front of the Dean's Hall and taken it back to their dorm room, and they were caught. So they decided to have a ceremony where they would re-weld the Osprey statue together, and they invited me to the Return of the Osprey ceremony. And so things just kept coming up Osprey. And suddenly I realized in my next book, two books down the line, I wrote a book called Soaring with Fidel. My new question wasn't, was how to be at home in movement. Because I realized I wasn't a one place person. I still go to Colorado in the summer, Cape down here. So it really helped me think about, their migratory part of their lives was a part of my life too. And then, I ended up seeing ospreys in Finland last summer. I ended up going to Venezuela probably wouldn't go now, but I went and saw 200 ospreys on a lake. And just, they kept, you know, it's the famous John Muir line, when you pick up one thing, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. They were hitched to everything. And so, and it's been nice that the book has had legs and it's kept going on. And it's made, you know, I've met many members of the Osprey tribe. And I just, I'm doing a feature for Audubon right now about the current situation with ospreys.
We're talking Osprey this hour with David Gessner, who 25 years ago penned Return of the Osprey, a season of flight and wonder. Coming up after a break, we talk about the remarkable comeback of the birds after the prohibition of DDT and what future threats they may face. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point, and we're talking about what could be the quintessential Cape and Island bird, the osprey. With us is David Gessner, the author of 14 books, including The Return of the Osprey, published 25 years ago. We also have two leading experts on osprey with us, Dr. Alan Poole. He lives along the Westport River and has been studying ospreys for over 35 years. He's written two books on the species, Osprey, The Revival of a Global Raptor, and Osprey, A Natural and Unnatural History. Alan, good to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us, Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary and also CAI's bird expert. You can hear the weekly bird report and the monthly bird news. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Alan, walk us through the rebound of osprey once DDT was banned.
Well, it was really quite remarkable. I think the thing to realize is that there were small nucleus populations left behind, Martha's Vineyard being one of the better known, that were less impacted by DDT. And so you had a small cluster of breeders that were left behind to help restart the population. Westport River here in Mass, another one of them. And by small, I mean 8 to 10 to a dozen, something like that. I think the Vineyard may have been down to 3 or 4 pairs. Anyway, the comeback was really unprecedented. It was remarkable. And by the mid to late 60s, by the late 60s, early 70s, DDT had been phased out of use, variety of reasons, local regulations cutting it back, and most importantly, federal regulations, which essentially banned it except for very rare uses, federal government coming in hard on that. And so during the 1970s and even and into the 1980s, you had a remarkable resurgence of ospreys coming back along our coasts. New York City to Boston population, one of the best studied, 1,000 pairs pre-DDT down to 90 pairs at the end of the DDT era. So essentially a 90% decline. By 1985, that population was back almost to historic levels, at least 2/3. A decade later, there were more than 1,000 pairs along that coast. Our local Westport population went from 8 or 10 to the time, by the time I got there studying it in the 80s, we were up to 30 to 40 pairs. And very quickly, in another 5 to 10 years, we were up to 60 to 80 pairs. So very few birds, two things, very few birds have been tracked this well during their recovery. So we know a lot about ospreys that we don't know about the recovery of other birds, fairly precise data, population data, and their ability to recover so quickly.
Yeah. Mark, what are some of the reasons, aside from the elimination of DDT, that have contributed to their success? As we know, especially on the Upper Cape, we've got a lot of nesting osprey.
Yes, it's people, right? It's that concerted effort to put up nesting platforms, you know, in the early days, bringing eggs up, you know, from other areas, jump-starting the population. But then, you know, it's the nesting platforms, really, because they're artificial and the predation rates are artificially low. They have very high productivity on the artificial nesting structures. And, you know, and they've branched out, as it were, into like light poles. That's a growth industry in the osprey real estate market. They love like the lights at baseball fields. Certainly utility poles, you know, cell phone towers. We offer them so many essentially predator-free places to nest that they're happy to adopt that I think the growth rates still, even after decades of exponential growth, are very, very high.
What other parts of the eastern U.S., besides our region, are there healthy populations of osprey? Where else do we see them? Anybody?
Well, it could be a good segue into the Chesapeake itself, where there were, or are still, between 10,000 and 12,000 nesting pairs. So kind of the epicenter of East Coast ospreys.
Yeah. So there have been concerns about declines in osprey populations in the Chesapeake and Connecticut. What kinds of declines are we seeing? What are we seeing there?
Well, I'll let Alan follow through, but I'll just kick us off and simply, you know, I started up the coast in fall. I was a little bit of a latecomer compared to Alan and others. But, you know, this is such an inherently hopeful story, as Mark was saying. It's like, you know, I think in the piece I called them shaggy flags of hope, seeing all the platforms, a kind of sign of penance from the bad old days of DDT. So I started to hear the news about trouble in the Chesapeake. And I didn't like the idea of my hopeful story being revised in a darker way. So I headed up there in the fall and I met with Brian Watts, who is at William & Mary and has been studying the birds for 30 years on the Chesapeake. And he, in three studies starting in 2023, had, on a very specific part of the bay at first, had noted that there were only, there were fewer than 10 successful pairs in over 100 nests in this Mobjack Bay. But then he spread the study out over the larger bay in the next 2 years. And he found that in the saline regions, in the salt regions of the bay, ospreys were not at a sustainable level, that the reproduction rates had fallen back below the DDT levels. Now, that wasn't true in the freshwater areas where their diet was more varied, but it was a scary number to have the heart of osprey country suddenly have the numbers be falling.
Hey, Alan, what do we think is happening there?
Well, the story is fairly clear, and it's as much a political one as it is biological. Ospreys in the lower parts of the bay and those saline reaches of Chesapeake Bay were heavily dependent on one species of fish, menhaden. They're known locally here as bunkers or pogies, but they are a fish that is a planktivore and is a surface swimming fish. They're about a foot long and they're very fat rich. They're an ideal osprey prey. And in Chesapeake, there were certain portions of this population, the Chesapeake population, that became heavily dependent, if not almost exclusively dependent during certain months on having menhaden available. And the rug got pulled out from under them. And what was happening is there is an industrial fishery there based along the coast of Virginia, omega protein, Canadian owned, vertically integrated. They run salmon farms. These menhaden are ground up into meal for chickens and pet chicken food, pet food, and primarily for aquaculture. And so as the pressures have mounted on these mid-Atlantic menhaden populations, the ospreys that were once dependent on them are finding themselves essentially without food. Their diet was not varied there, and they really got out on a limb. They got out on a menhaden limb, and that limb is getting sawed off.
And the industrial fishing takes 100 million pounds out of the bay itself. 300, Virginia is the only state that allows reduction or industrial fishing. And they head up the coast, in the coastal waters of Virginia, but in the federal waters off New Jersey and up toward New York. And they're taking, you know, a significant amount out of the bay. And there's a political push to stop it. But they're powerful. They have lobbyists, and they have objected to not just the reduction in the quota, but to any significant study of the numbers of menhaden in the bay. And Alan, you were saying to me the other day that that's the crucial thing. We don't know how many menhaden are. There are the numbers.
That's right. The biology is very poorly known. It's very vague at this point. We know where menhaden spawn. We know their movements to a certain extent. We don't know to what extent New England menhaden populations are related to these mid-Atlantic populations. It would be good to have genetics data on that. It would be good just all over to understand more about them. And this effort has been fought quite hard by this group, this omega protein group. As far as the, Mindy, you were asking about the spillover, we're seeing ripples, certainly into New Jersey. New Jersey ospreys are producing only half as many young as they did a decade ago. That's been well documented and well studied. Connecticut seems to be doing, you mentioned Connecticut. Connecticut is not really in a worrisome situation right now, but it bears watching. Again, we're seeing ospreys emerging as a barometer species. These are an indicator species. They're telling us in the old days what was happening in terms of the pollution of our waters and our fish. Right now, they're telling us about the health of our fish populations. And so New Jersey is very much dependent, I think, on those same fish that are coming out of Virginia waters. And those populations, especially in southern New Jersey, are crashing. They are producing less than half as many young as they did a decade ago and not at sustainable rates. Connecticut's still in sustainable territory, but showing some worrisome trends. Westport, the populations I study here, in southeastern Mass, are two out of every three young in the last couple of years have starved in our nests. And a decade ago, when menhaden were more available, that was not the case. Mm-hmm. So here again, a very good indicator of what's going on in our waters is something as simple as the size of the broods that ospreys are fledging. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a three young brood fledge in our nests in the last 5 years, very few. In the last 2 years, almost none.
Yeah, I say very worrisome. But Mark, talk about our osprey here. Well, we have, you know, Upper Cape, you know, is rebounded big time. They're not eating menhaden, right?
Well, they might be, but I mean, it's so surprising to me because I'm most familiar with the Cape population. The Cape and Islands population is just skyrocketing. I mean, there's just so many osprey and they are pumping out chicks, but we have an embarrassment of riches. There are so many different water bodies, so many different kinds of fish that they're eating here. 800 freshwater bodies, all of the, you know, the bay, the sound, the Atlantic Ocean, all the marshes, the herring runs, right? They have different favorites at different times of year. Right now it's herring, you know, the snapper blues will come in. It's just they're so well buffered here. I don't know what's going on with menhaden. When I look at the stock, the biomass has been going up during my lifetime, according to the ASMFC. There's not very much harvest in Massachusetts compared to other areas. I don't know what's going on with menhaden. I hear whispers.
The biomass figures are a little bit, they can be massaged in different ways.
Oh, I know.
Because it hit so low, disastrous lows in the 70s. Sure, it's gone up since then, but it's actually gone down in recent years where it's scary enough.
Do we know why the osprey in the Chesapeake area aren't turning to other fish to eat? Is it just simply there are no other smaller fish species? No other options for them?
There aren't enough. There are two things here. There aren't enough of them. And the fish that are available have much less fat and are much less nutrient dense. So it has to do with both the number of fish and the quality of the fish. Mm.
Yeah, they're little power bombs of, Brian Watts was saying this is three times the energy they're getting from another fish, and they've evolved for that fish there. And then, as I continued up through New Jersey, in Sedge Island, a beautiful area in southern New Jersey, there was a nest that had produced 40 platforms that have produced 55 young 2 years before and produced five last year. So this continued up. And the other thing that's affecting it is you're seeing the numbers fall in the bait fisheries. Like, they're, it's also harvested to use for for lobsters, for other things, and those numbers are falling dramatically. So I think like the difference between what Mark's describing and Alan, and both of you in Massachusetts, you're kind of getting the ocean curl and you're probably still in Menhaden world, right? And Mark, here on the Cape, you're, you know, you've got all the lakes and the bay and so much, so, you know, because that's what Brian Watts is concluding in Chesapeake too, is the diversity of the freshwater or the kind of near freshwater fish is so much greater. And so the ospreys there aren't being affected the way the saline waters are.
Yeah. I wish I had better, better data, but I used to have a volunteer, and Lewis Bay, so right basically Hyannis Harbor, who would actually note all of the fish brought in by the pair of osprey. So I have volunteers who monitor osprey nests, which is how I'm able to kind of track their productivity. And you know, that was just one snapshot of one embayment, that Lewis Bay, a larger area around Hyannis Harbor. And it, you know, it was mostly scup, a lot of flounder, you know, a puffer fish once, you know, bluefish, the occasional striped bass, don't tell anyone. But, you know, just a great diversity of things. And then, you know, there's white perch and yellow perch and just everything in the fresh water. So yeah, we're very lucky here. Yeah. I mean, the ospreys are very lucky here.
Yeah. And I think all through the East Coast, you know, it's hard to believe this story because you just, ospreys are so abundant, you feel right. Like whenever you're along the coast.
Yeah.
But you know, it's worth noticing what might be coming.
Yeah,
Alan, right. And there's an ally in the striped bass community,
totally.
Right? And this is a big vocal, very vocal community, and they are all anti-omega too right now. So it's not just osprey folks, especially recreational, but really anybody fishing for striped bass is looking to curtail the menhaden harvest, and they are harvesting them or being used more up here as lobster bait.
Because the Atlantic herring population is diving. So,
right.
You know. For me, one of the interesting things is you've got like this across the aisle thing. Alan, you actually met with people from the White House, right? And you've got kind of old fashioned conservatism, like Teddy Roosevelt style, where you've got the striper people and the Teddy Roosevelt conservation group uniting with Sierra and Audubon. Like, so it's a rare. And Alan showed me a video where you've got a lot of fishermen saying, we've got to stop this overfishing in Menhaden. And several of them were wearing MAGA hats. So it's a strange reaching across the
island. I was going to say, Alan, you sort of touched on what you're seeing on the South Coast. You're sort of in the middle there. We've got, you know, some big concerns in, you know, the Chesapeake Bay, New Jersey, and parts of Connecticut. We've got the, you know, abundance of diversity here on the Cape. What are your concerns as you're looking at that South Coast population? Do they have the ability for the diversity of the fish as well, or not as much? What's happening there?
They do and they don't. They're right on the edge. So it depends on the week or even the month. There are certain times of year where historically they were much more dependent, our population here, and to a certain extent, Connecticut and probably Rhode Island as well, although we don't know the data there. We're heavily dependent on menhaden. Not to say there aren't other fish. There are, but they're fewer of them and they're harder to find. I mean, menhaden are the low-hanging fruit. And if you can get them, life is easy. And the thing to realize about osprey populations that has surprised me over the last 30 years is that there is great variation among the males of the foragers. Some of them are good and some of them are less good. So we have in our population about 30% of the pairs, and I'll bet it's the same on the Cape and the Vineyard, 30% of the pairs that are producing 60, maybe in some years, even 70% of the young. So a lot of pairs fail, and they fail because they can't find enough fish. And then there are those males that are motivated, talented, they have chutzpah, who knows what it's all about, but they are able to bring in they bring home the bacon, and there are the ones that are producing more of the young than others in the population. So that's the thing to realize. We look at ospreys and we think, oh, they're all the same. They're not.
They're not, yeah. We're talking osprey this hour, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking osprey this morning, both the amazing success story of these birds and what might threaten their numbers in the future. So we went into the break, and Mark, you had a thought?
You know, Alan and I are in this working group organized by a guy named Dave Rimmer, retired from Essex County Greenbelt, who does great work herding cats in terms of the those of us looking at different osprey populations in Massachusetts. And he asked us to estimate all, you know, these different subpopulations. And, you know, we have that data, and it looks like there's been a shift inland in the Westport River area. And I just wanted to ask Alan about that, where, you know, the number of nesting pairs, the sort of original main populations on the two branches of the river might even be going down, but there are more nests inland than there were, you know, less than 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. The data are much harder to come by for those freshwater inland populations. They're harder to census, and there are fewer people in there that are getting the numbers. But we're certainly hearing lots of reports of birds in areas like the Lakeville area, where you've got a lot of fresh water and big trees for them to nest in. We're seeing more trees here. In terms of our numbers, we're fairly steady, and we are held down on the number of platforms. Our local conservation commission has given us a limit, which makes perfect sense. I have no problems with that. We have 100 nests on the Westport River. I don't think we need 1,000. So we're happy with 100. So I think part of what we're seeing, Mark, is the spillover from our population that has been producing fairly well up until recently. Those birds got to go somewhere, and a lot of them are probably moving inland.
Yeah. Now they're young. Now, the osprey fly south in the fall. Do we know where do our birds go in the fall?
One place they go through is Cuba.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a great, I spent some time there and watched, you know, most raptors are hydrophobic and are going to head Mexico way. But in Cuba, you see a pure line of ospreys coming down the ridge of the mountains. And it's pretty thrilling.
And this is true for the Chesapeake birds, too. It's all of the birds up here, they all go to the same
place? Yeah, most of the Atlantic coast birds are flying the same route. They fly down the Atlantic coast, some of them out over the ocean, but mostly along they're on rails. They go right down along the coast through Florida, out to the Florida Keys, jump to Cuba. When you get to Cuba, you take a left.
Yeah.
That's the instruction that comes with the osprey brain, our osprey's brain. You take a left in Cuba and you go through Cuba over the mountains where David, to his credit, got up and met the people who were monitoring the birds there, wrote a wonderful book about it, if you don't have it, Soaring with Fidel. It's a great story of osprey migration.
Yeah.
And then from there, they take the shortest route over the Caribbean. It's about a day, a 24 to 30-hour flight. Incredible flight when you think about it. They're flying day and night. They can't land on the water. They're fighting storms. If it's cloudy, they're not seeing the sky. They've got the built-in calibrated GPS to get them to Venezuela and Colombia. And as David also discovered, they basically go through one spot. Most of them go through one spot right at the border of Colombia and Venezuela. And there's a big lake there, Maracaibo. They spend time getting back into shape, getting tanked up with food. And then they spread out over the Amazon from there. Now, that's not to say there aren't birds that winter in the Caribbean or along the Caribbean coast of Central America, but the vast majority of them head into the Amazon. So it's quite extraordinary. Think about it. Our osprey is showing up here in late March and early April, have just left, well, just 2 to 3 weeks earlier, have left a river tributary, remote section of the Amazon, living on South American fish. Who knows what they're eating there?
Yeah. And where I live, we have residential ospreys as well who don't take off.
Yeah, I was going to say Florida ospreys, you know, a lot of times. They just stay in Florida, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
So what determines where an osprey migrates to? For example, why do, you know, we have the Cape and Islands ospreys come here and, you know, not the Long Island Sound or Chesapeake ospreys? You know, they go, is it where they just go back to their originals? What about the young ones? Why don't they say, hey, not enough fish here, let's go to the Cape Cod?
It's like the Cape Cod migration. The people from Worcester go to East Dennis, and the people from Western Mass go to Falmouth or whatever. No, I don't know, Alan. You guys, you know that better than me.
Yeah, I mean, we have fairly good data on that going back to the early days when Paul Spitzer was color banding ospreys along the New York to Boston coast. And what Paul showed was that the young, first of all, they don't return right away. They have a gap year. They spend 18 months in the Amazon. Then when they come back, they're more regionally based. So if you're a vineyard, if you hatch from the vineyard, and Rob Beauregard's transmitter birds, the satellite transmitter birds, gave us some glimpses into this. You might go to the vineyard, but then you might wander around. You might end up in the Cape. You might get over to Connecticut. So essentially, it's teenagers coming home, getting the keys to the car, and riding around until they find a place they like. That's really what it's all about. And finding a place you like has a lot to do with the amount of food that's there. So, yes, they are essentially sampling the waters. They're not going to settle in a place where they get no food. But remember that food changes. It's not standard all the way through the season. So you arrive on the Cape. They're herring galore in April and May, and then the herring are gone. You have to turn to something else.
Yeah.
So most of these birds are spending a year or two wandering around, sampling various areas, and then they settle generally within 50 to 100 miles of where they fledged.
Yeah.
Mark, and I think Rob Beauregard, who's satellite tracked so many ospreys in this region, did a lot of work on the vineyard. The young birds start exploring in their first migration, basically. They do crazy things, you know, as teenagers do. The adult ospreys really just beeline to their wintering grounds, and they have a very compact fall migration. But we tracked an East Ham juvenile osprey that went from East Ham to Provincetown to Boston to the New Hampshire border to the Connecticut River, down to the Delaware water gap, north significantly into rural Pennsylvania until it started snowing.
Oh, my.
Then went and did a normal migration, right? So they're sort of exploring the region right away, as soon as they get kicked out and do their first fall migration. And, you know, there's thought that that might benefit them later on, either finding other fishing areas they can use when their local fishing areas dry up, or potential future places to nest.
Mark, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, we know Falmouth has this explosion of nesting pairs. Do we know why Falmouth is so popular to these birds? I mean, when you look at, you know, the Cape wide, and what kinds of trends are you seeing in healthy nesting pairs Cape wide?
Right. When we know so much about Falmouth because of Kevin Friel and the Falmouth Osprey Project, this is a photographer basically who just decided one year, I'm going to try to photograph every osprey nest in Falmouth. And it just so happened that was a fateful year where Eversource just undertook, in retrospect, was a disastrous effort to just rip down a bunch of nests that were on utilities and not put up deterrents at all or right away. And it was a disaster. There were fires and outages left and right. And that sort of spawned this effort to do better with ospreys on power lines that culminated several years later. And there is now an email address. You can email ospreys@eversource.com, or you can Google the Cape Osprey Plan for Eversource, and they will actually respond to dangerous nests. And we've been meeting with them for years about that. But Falmouth sort of started all that. And I don't know what it is about Falmouth other than all of the coastline, all of the different bodies of water. Again, it's just sort of a microcosm of what makes the Cape work. And the Cape is not uniform. I'm still not aware of a nesting pair of ospreys in Provincetown. you know, Truro has 5. Mm-hmm. Falmouth has 180. So it is not a uniform distribution. And so, yes, as you're saying, there's something about Falmouth, and the more you move west, the more you get to the Upper Cape, the more there are. Barnstaple has a ton. There's just a lot of shoreline. There's a lot of places for them to fish.
Is there a point,
Mark? I'm wondering. Food and nest sites are the key limiting factors for right. any bird population, and ospreys especially. And I'm wondering if Falmouth, because of the herring runs there, and perhaps because of efforts with nest building platforms, if that helped sort of jumpstart that population there.
Yes. You know, but I mean, other towns have herring runs and platforms, mm-hmm. and I don't have a sense of who put the platforms up in Falmouth. You know, they just sort of, you know, we used to put up some, we being Mass Audubon, on more towards the outer and lower Cape. But for the rest of the Cape, I don't really know who put them up, but they just spring up, right? Mm-hmm. And they're private landowners put them up, have a contractor put them up, whatever. But there are so many. And that's certainly part of it. I don't know if Falmouth has like more per capita than other areas, but yeah, it's the right recipe for making more ospreys. Falmouth has it.
Is there a best way to track the health of the population so we can have early warning signs if the birds are facing challenges? I guess keeping an eye on what's going on in the Chesapeake, right? But what are some of the other ways we can keep an eye and track this population?
I can talk about a really terrific effort that's happening in Connecticut, really a model for how to monitor a large osprey state, in that case, a statewide osprey population. Connecticut Audubon has this program called Osprey Nation. It's a great website. I encourage people to take a look at it. And it'll show you what well-organized citizen science projects can accomplish. And they are essentially monitoring, well, I won't say every nest in Connecticut, but I bet they're getting 80. They're easily getting 80 to 90%. And we're talking about hundreds of nests here. I think Connecticut is now up to 600 to 800, something like that. So with an army of citizens, well-trained, you can get a lot done. And that's a great model for keeping a finger on the pulse of what's happening in a larger area, you know, essentially statewide.
Mark, any thoughts on that?
Yes, exactly. I mean, they're such a great model for citizen science. I mean, people can just go out and look at the nests, right? It's not like a cerulean warbler where good luck finding the nest. I mean, they're just out there doing their thing in open air. So, and there are so many kind of sub projects. Like, they just started one on Nantucket. Libby Buck at Linda Loring just started one just overnight, just about last year. And so now volunteers can monitor nests on Nantucket, and there's a website already. I don't even have a website. I've been trying to, I've had volunteers monitoring nests for, you know, close to 20 years now here on the Cape, and mine is still sort of primitive. I'm working on getting web-based data entry for that. But I have a pretty good sampling going back to about 2008 in terms of productivity here on the Cape. And I'm just trying to keep up with the nest sites. Yeah. I need people to email me new nest sites. I have a sort of an out-of-date Google map of nest sites, and I need people to send me the new ones.
All right.
But it's hard to keep up. They pop up on power lines. They get taken down. They move somewhere else. It's a real game of whack-a-mole. But we're talking about 600 pairs of ospreys now on the Cape. Around when I was born in the 70s, and my understanding is there was one pair then, one mm-hmm. or two, somewhere on yeah. you know, Nantucket Sound maybe, yeah. and now there's 600.
So a long way, yeah.
That's all pretty right. good.
Mark Faraday's ornithologist and science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Ornithologist Alan Poole, author of Osprey, The Revival of a Global Raptor, and Osprey, A Natural and Unnatural History. And David Gessner, author of Return of the Osprey, published 25 years ago. David will be giving a talk about osprey at the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History in Brewster on June 7th. And on June 9th, he'll be at the Sturgis Library for a talk called Writing Cape Cod. We'll post links with more information about all of our guests at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.